Thank you very much, Cliff, for organising this. It's the first talk. The book came out 2 days ago, so it really is extremely exciting for me to come back to Hyde Park, the place where it all began. And thank you very much for coming. So this is where the Roosevelts' married life began, in Hyde Park, and where it ended. Franklin, who was born and raised in the grand Hudson Valley house just over there, brought his bride here in March 1905 for the first week of their honeymoon. 40 years later, Franklin was buried here, and in 1962, Eleanor was buried beside him in the Rose Garden, a lovely symbol of the original Dutch family name, Rosenfeld, meaning field of roses. The marriage might not always have been a bed of roses, but the standard view of this marriage strikes me as surprisingly negative. This book began for me when I first came to the FDR Museum soon after I moved to New York. While our tour group moved through the house, people were asking, wasn't the marriage just a public facade? Wasn't Eleanor really a lesbian? And wasn't Franklin in love with another woman? I found myself wondering how on earth it was possible for a man from this sheltered, aristocratic world, who was struck by polio at the age of 39 and never again able to take a step on his own to become President of the United States. How was it possible for a shy, insecure woman from a prominent Republican family to become the most progressive, outspoken, independent, courageous, and controversial First Lady this country has ever known? It seemed to me that the answer had a great deal to do with the marriage. One person in our tour group asked if there was a good book on the Roosevelts as a couple. Nothing recent, the guide replied. She mentioned Eleanor and Franklin by Joseph Lasch, which is now 40 years old, and Doris Kearns Goodwin's No Ordinary Time, which is about the war years, the last 5 years of the Roosevelts' 40-year marriage. By the time I drove back to Manhattan, the sun was setting, and the seed of my next book was in my head. I soon found out that the Roosevelt marriage is still shrouded in mystery. It's astounding when you think about it. We're talking about the most famous presidential couple ever. From the day of their wedding in March 1905, when the bride was given away by her father's brother, President Theodore Roosevelt, their marriage was played out in the public gaze. When Franklin died in 1945 at the beginning of his fourth term as president, he and Eleanor had lived in the White House for 12 years. Somehow, even as the most famous couple in the nation, living under relentless scrutiny, Franklin and Eleanor managed to lead quite unconventional private lives, keeping major details hidden from the public. Roosevelt biographers take sides. Some see Franklin as the long-suffering partner, while others claim it was Eleanor. Nearly all see the marriage as a kind of tragic compromise patched together by two lonely people. I find this a strangely conventional and condescending interpretation of the bold and radical partnership that has made Franklin and Eleanor go down in history as one of the most powerful and inspiring couples of all times. In tonight's talk, I hope to give you some idea. Of course, I can't tell you much of the stories, many of the stories that are in the book, but I hope to give you some idea of the turning points that gradually made it the bold and radical marriage it became, and to give you a sense of the generosity that was at the heart of it. It's going to be an illustrated talk, and then at the end I hope we will have an animated discussion, the kind that the Roosevelts used to enjoy at their dinner table. It started out as an utterly conventional marriage between aristocrats. This was the Victorian era. High society in New York was hidebound, much more so than in Europe, as Eleanor found out when she was in England at finishing school. And Franklin and Eleanor were even more constrained than most young couples, since they lived under the thumb of Franklin's mother. Sarah Roosevelt had always been a domineering presence in Franklin's life, and she made sure this continued after his marriage. Widowed at 46, she possessed a vast fortune, and yet throughout her long life, even when her son was president of the U.S., she only ever gave Franklin money in the form of handouts. As a Christmas present the year Franklin and Eleanor married, Mama, as Franklin and Eleanor both called her, had a house built for them, a handsome, neo-Georgian, double townhouse on East 65th Street. The catch, half the house was to be occupied by Mama. There were no photographers at the wedding, so this is a studio photograph taken several weeks beforehand. Here they are after they're married at Hyde Park. They're joking a bit because he's got her knitting and she's got his glass. Here they are 5 years into the marriage at Campo Bello. I think you can see that it was a very playful and affectionate relationship. Here she's still the Victorian lady, even at a picnic with her long dress. Here's the house that Mama had built for them, the double house, with a common entrance and connecting doors on most of the floors. And this, you know, this is Hyde Park, where we are. Sorry, gone back. Two, I'm jumping ahead. And then, so the first years of the marriage were not particularly happy. Franklin worked as a lawyer, which he didn't much like. Eleanor had 4 babies in 5.5 years, which she didn't much like. And Mama was constantly bustling through the connecting doors. And then in 1910, five and a half years into the marriage, Franklin and Eleanor took their first bold step away from tradition. The American aristocracy traditionally voted Republican. Franklin, like his father before him, saw himself as a Democrat. Because President Theodore Roosevelt was a progressive Republican, unlike some of the Republicans we see today, most of them, he believed, Theodore Roosevelt, in government regulation of big business, workers' compensation, women's suffrage, and social insurance. So Franklin had no qualms about casting his first vote for his cousin as president. But after Theodore Roosevelt's presidency ended, Franklin ran as a Democratic candidate for the New York State Senate. Franklin was just 28, and he was running in the solidly Republican Hudson Valley farming district where he grew up, right here. No one thought he had a chance, and as you know, he won the seat. This was 1910. American women didn't get the vote for another 10 years, but Eleanor stood proudly beside her husband. It wasn't without conflict for her. The extended Roosevelt tribe and most of Franklin and Eleanor's aristocratic friends despised Franklin's Democratic politics. They saw him as a traitor to his class. As a state senator, Franklin moved the family to Albany, which, to Eleanor's relief, put a large stretch of road between them and Mama. During their 3 years in Albany, 3 important things happened. Franklin led an insurrection against the corrupt forces of Tammany Hall, the Democratic Party machinery in New York City, and became something of a hero in national Democratic circles. Louis Howe, a small, intense, chain-smoking journalist, came to the Roosevelt House to interview Franklin and went home convinced that he had just met the future president of the United States. And Eleanor began to develop an interest in politics. Friends remarked that in the Albany years, Franklin and Eleanor looked much happier and more confident than before. In March 1913, Franklin, at the age of 31, landed the prestigious post of Assistant Secretary of the Navy, just like Theodore Roosevelt had before him. The family moved to Washington. Louis Howe, who had become a close friend of Franklin's, was proving to be a brilliant political strategist, and Franklin employed him as his assistant. Eleanor went to extraordinary lengths to help Franklin in his job, braving seasickness to accompany him on inspection tours, paying hundreds of social calls, hostessing dinners. When she found herself pregnant again, she employed a secretary to help her out. Lucy Mercer, an attractive young woman with a sunny personality, soon became part of the Roosevelt household. In the summer of 1918, Franklin sailed to Europe to inspect American naval operations on the front line. Eleanor stayed in Washington, working long shifts in a steaming hot Red Cross kitchen that provided food for soldiers in transit. In mid-September, Franklin came home with double pneumonia and had to be carried off the ship on a stretcher. When Eleanor unpacked his suitcase, she discovered a stack of love letters from Lucy. Many biographers see this as a major turning point in the marriage. I'm sure you all know about it. After which the marriage, they say, never entirely recovered. I don't see it this way at all. We know very little about Franklin's romance with Lucy. We don't even know whether it was consummated. But for some reason, much has been made of Lucy as the love of his life. This is partly because Lucy happened to be among the group of friends in Warm Springs who were with Franklin when he died. He invited a lot of adoring women, and she was one of them. I don't want to idealize the marriage. The marriage was certainly not without problems. And of course it was a shock for Eleanor to come across the love letters. But their bond was strong enough to transcend this crisis. In the months after the Lucy Mercer affair, Franklin still called his wife Dearest Babs. She called him Dearest Honey. Years later, Eleanor would write in her autobiography that there was a point when she had to come to terms with certain things. I quote, "I decided to accept the fact that a man must be what he is. Life must be lived as it is." She was clearly referring to the Lucy Mercer episode. I know she couldn't talk about it in her autobiography, but this vague reference to it. She also realized that she had to find an identity beyond being a wife. She was 35. The war was over. The world had changed. Values had changed. Eleanor, too, was changing. You know how the end of the First World War was really an incredible turning point in the world, sometimes I think rather like today. She was no longer remotely interested in being a gentlewoman like Mama. Indeed, Eleanor had finished with trying to please Mama, whose opinions increasingly struck her as belonging to a bygone world. Eleanor's war work had given her immense satisfaction, and now that the family was growing up, she was eager to throw herself into public service. In October 1919, Eleanor attended the International Congress of Working Women. These were activist labor women who talked about the exploitation of women workers and questioned the traditional role of women in marriage. Within a few years, some of them would be Eleanor's closest friends. That's Lucy Mercer and Franklin. And here's Franklin in 1918 in France, on that trip when he went to inspect the American Navy operations on the front line. He was in his prime. This is at the height of his romance with Lucy Mercer. But for the moment, 1919-1920, Eleanor was still primarily a wife. In June 1920, Franklin, at the age of 38, was nominated as the Democratic Party candidate for vice president. Francis Perkins, FDR's future Secretary of Labor, described him at the Democratic Convention. "Tall, strong, handsome, and popular, he was one of the stars of the show. I recall how he displayed his athletic ability by vaulting over a row of chairs to get to the platform in a hurry." Eleanor joined Franklin on his campaign trip across the country. For the first time, women had the vote, and Eleanor made a difference. It was almost certain that the Democrats would lose, and they did, but Franklin made a very positive impact on the national stage. He privately hoped to run next time as presidential candidate. In the meantime, he planned to run as governor of New York. In the summer of 1921, Franklin seemed to be nicely on course for the bully pulpit. For the first time in years, he was planning to spend the whole summer at Campo Bello with his family. Here you've got the family at that time. This is 1920, Mama in the middle. They're not looking very happy, but maybe the sun was in their eyes. You can see that they're still a Victorian family, Eleanor in her long dress and long hair. Here is Campo Bello, which if you've never been to is worth a visit. You can see around this place that they called the cottage, which Mama bought for them. It's next door to Mama's house. And then here is Campo Bello. I mean, when we went up there, frankly, it was a bit difficult for us to understand why, except for the house, for the fact that Mama had bought them a house, so somewhat compelling them to go there, or at least Eleanor and the children while Franklin worked. But, you know, it's a rocky island with these kinds of beaches. The tides are extremely dangerous. There are signs all over the island saying be careful not to be trapped by the tide or you'll be stuck for 8 hours. Lots of lighthouses. Very cold, even in the summer. Often they had to light fires in August. Fires were a permanent hazard. There was no electricity in the house, just cold water. The Roosevelts loved getting away from it all on this Canadian island, strictly speaking, French-speaking, just off the northern part of Maine. So, for the first time in years, 1921, Franklin was planning to spend the whole summer at Campo Bello with his family. The five Roosevelt children, who ranged in age from 15 to 5, were thrilled at the prospect of seeing a bit of their father. Louis Howe was there with his family. Louis and Franklin, while they carved little wooden boats on the back porch, made plans for Franklin's run as governor. Eleanor was grateful for the respite from Mama, who was spending the summer with her sister in France. Franklin, who was always a restless, vigorous, athletic man, was sailing, running, swimming, camping with the kids. And then came catastrophe, as you know, a catastrophe of unimaginable proportions. On Wednesday, August the 10th, Franklin went to bed shivering and aching all over. By Friday, most of his body was paralyzed. This was 1921. Campo Bello was a remote island off the northern coast of Maine. There were no helicopters to airlift him to a hospital. There was no bridge on which an ambulance could cross. The one telephone on the island at the small general store in Welshpool offered no privacy, and it would have caused panic on the island if Eleanor had described Franklin's condition on the phone. The nearest doctor had to boat across the strait from Lübeck. He showed Eleanor how to insert a catheter with great care to avoid infection and how to administer an enema. I mean, Franklin was paralyzed. Absolutely, at this point, even his face. He couldn't hold a pen. He was a paralyzed man. He couldn't turn in bed. He couldn't move. She nursed him without any training. Incredibly brilliantly, apparently. By the time a polio specialist arrived on the island, Franklin had been lying in agony for 14 days, unable to move or turn. With Eleanor beside him, you can see where she slept in the window bed, nursing him around the clock. It was polio, as they feared. 16 years into the marriage, Franklin, at the age of 39, had become a paraplegic. That winter, back at 4749 East 65th Street, the household was in turmoil. Franklin, Eleanor, Mama, and the children were adjusting to these frightening new circumstances. Franklin had a valet, a strong black man, to lift him around and help him dress. Louis Howe moved in to look after Franklin's work commitments. Howe, an asthmatic, smoked like a chimney, coughed all day and wheezed all night. Mama couldn't stand him, that dirty little man, she called him. The children resented Louis Howe's authority in the house and were jealous of their mother's affection for him. Meanwhile, Louis Howe's family lived in Poughkeepsie, where the daughter went to Vassar, and it was cheaper rent. But Louis Howe's wife was extremely jealous of Eleanor and accused him of having an affair with her, which I'm absolutely sure he never did, but I'm trying to explain the turmoil generally. Franklin was becoming very dependent on his live-in nurse, a pretty young woman with a bubbling sense of humour. Above all, a titanic power struggle was taking place between the women of the house. Mama wanted Franklin to retire to Hyde Park, where he could be a gentleman invalid in a wheelchair and she would look after him. Eleanor, who understood that this would destroy Franklin's spirit, encouraged him to practice walking on crutches and to keep up his work and political interests. Franklin's nurse and physiotherapist both felt, just like Mama did, that Eleanor was pushing him too hard. In later years, Franklin's doctors would agree that Franklin's mental rehabilitation owed a great deal to Eleanor. After a year, Franklin's nurse departed, leaving a void in Franklin's life, which was gradually filled by his young secretary, Marguerite Lahand. The children called her Missy, and the name stuck. In the winter of 1923, after 18 months in which Franklin had been largely confined to his homes in New York and Hyde Park, he headed south with Missy, his valet, and a group of friends to spend 6 weeks on a rented houseboat in the waters off Florida, cruising, fishing, and swimming. The following winter, he bought an old houseboat, the LaRocco. Soon after, he discovered Warm Springs, Georgia, a run-down resort spa with a warm, open-air pool fed by a natural spring. From 1924 to 1928, Franklin was away more often than he was home. He spent most of the time in the South with Missy. I mean, I don't know about you, but I personally feel this is very understandable. The man had to re-find himself, find his sense of self, find his sense of manhood. Eleanor was a wonderful wife, but she expected huge amounts from him and was pushing him. He needed an attendant. He needed somebody who didn't expect too much from him, someone cheerful, patient, someone like Missy, to help him come to terms with himself. And I think he needed to be away from the family, the kids, his mother, Eleanor, the whole thing. Eleanor understood that Franklin needed to get away from family tensions, his mother's solicitude and her own pushing. She also understood that however grueling the physical struggle, Franklin's main battle was psychological. Her restless, ambitious husband faced the supreme task of remaking his life. If his adoring secretary Missy could help him feel like a man again, Eleanor was not going to complain. I mean, there's no doubt that the relationship with Missy was romantic and in some degree sexual. We don't know how, but we don't know in which degrees, but I'm sure it was, and I'm happy for him. Everybody seems to make this thing about, you know, Franklin and his huge narcissistic need for conquests. I do think we have to understand the context. This was his life now. 10-pound braces, heavy metal and leather on each leg in order to be able to stand, with shoes attached to the bottom. You can see that he painted the bottom of the braces black so they wouldn't show up so much under his trousers. A wheelchair. He liked an absolutely regular chair, narrower, easier to maneuver into elevators and so on, and it made him feel less like an invalid, less like a handicapped man. But that was his life from now on. This man who had gone sailing, horse riding, swimming, ice skating on the Hudson, loved, and I mean, it was constantly, his physicality was constantly talked about in the newspapers, the vaulting of the chairs to get to the platform kind of thing. This was him in Warm Springs in 1924. He used to cover up his legs, sort of, you know, for photos with either a newspaper or his arms. You can see his upper body strength. You can see his shriveled legs. This was Missy in Warm Springs. You can see how kind she looks. His secretary, she was extremely good as a secretary, but she was also a kind companion. But she also was prone to depression and had some extremely dramatic nervous breakdowns. So Eleanor wasn't going to complain about Missy. She was rather pleased that Missy dealt with the life down in the South, which she hated, the heat, the Jim Crow racism, the sitting around with fishing rods for hours on end, the drinking prohibition cocktails in the evening, banter. This was not Eleanor's scene. Meanwhile, Louis Howe, he was living in the house, encouraged Eleanor to enter the political fray herself. Not only was it important that women play an active role in the Democratic Party, he told her, but it was the best way to keep politics alive in the Roosevelt household and the family name in front of the public. As Louis had predicted, Eleanor found the political domain thrilling. She had the organizational skills, commitment, and charisma to make her remarkably good at it. In no time, she became the leading figure in the women's division of the New York State Democratic Committee. Mama intensely disliked the new friends Eleanor was making. Educated professional women, left-wing political activists, some of whom with their short hair, cigarette holders, and knickerbockers looked like dapper young men. This was the Roaring Twenties. We were no longer in the Victorian era. Behind Eleanor's back, Cousin Alice called them female impersonators. Franklin's half-brother Rosie referred to them as Eleanor's parlor pinks. Even Franklin and Louis Howe jokingly called them she-males. Eleanor had grown particularly close to Nancy Cook on the left as you face the photo and Marianne Dickerman on the right as you face the photo, a lesbian couple. Franklin enjoyed their company. Nancy and Marion thought Franklin the most utterly charming man they'd ever met. Most people did. And the two women became part of what Franklin liked to call our gang. One evening, the gang was picnicking in a favorite spot at Hyde Park near Valkill, the creek, and Eleanor remarked wistfully that it was a pity winter was coming and this would be their last picnic for the season, for they could never feel free like this at home with Mama. Franklin looked around and had a flash of inspiration. "This isn't Mother's land," he said. "I bought this acreage myself. Why shouldn't you three have a cottage here of your own so you could come and go as you please?" Franklin designed the stone cottage. He fancied himself as an architect and was surprisingly good at it. It was built within a year. Mama was not happy about Valkill. With this house of her own, Eleanor had issued an unambiguous declaration of independence. Franklin called it the love nest and honeymoon cottage. He was taking a subversive delight in Eleanor's new life. That's the beautiful old stone cottage. Dutch field stone overlooking a lovely pond. And here's the swimming pool that they built out of the pond. You see Franklin, Missy in the middle, and Eleanor. On March the 17th, 1925, 4 years after polio changed their lives, Franklin and Eleanor celebrated their 20th wedding anniversary on the Loroco with the gang off Florida. Although those on board might not have thought so at the time, there was good reason for celebration. After 20 years of married life, the Roosevelts had achieved something rare. Their marriage was as strong as ever, and yet they had broken free from its traditional confines. By now it was clear to all their friends that Franklin and Eleanor were no longer a traditional couple. They also had independent lives which involved other close companions. It was a daring direction to go in, particularly for Franklin, who still harboured political ambitions and who, as a paraplegic, was already facing an uphill battle with his image. But polio had convinced him more than ever of the virtues and joys of communal life. He needed people around him, and since he couldn't get around, he needed the world to come to him. While he had no choice in the matter of his dependence, he was careful not to depend too much on any one person. He also made sure there was reciprocity. One of the things that gave Franklin most satisfaction was to provide the opportunity for people to do the things they did best. He could see that Eleanor was happiest in New York, working in the political domain with her women friends. Louis Howe was brilliant at masterminding things behind the scenes. Missy enjoyed being Franklin's secretary and daily companion. Everyone in the group relied on everyone else and opened up new possibilities for each other. Franklin liked this kind of bold social arrangement. Eleanor, too, had grown much bolder since Franklin's polio. Courage is more exhilarating than fear, she told friends, and in the long run, it is easier. They needed their courage. Franklin hadn't recovered any of his mobility. Missy would later confide to a friend, there were days on the Loroco when it was noon before he could pull himself out of his depression and greet his guests wearing his light-hearted facade. Franklin constantly worried that his political ambitions were delusional. How could he possibly run for office when he couldn't even walk? At the 1924 Democratic National Convention, Franklin had made his first public appearance since polio. As he made his way painstakingly to the stage on crutches, the famous aristocrat had in some ways become the common man. He stood at the podium in a grey and white suit, and the light poured down on him that day. His delivery was magnetic. The crowd went berserk. The press described him in almost mythical terms as a hero who had been strengthened and purified by adversity. 4 years later, at the 1928 Democratic National Convention in Houston, Franklin made his second appearance since polio. This time he was determined that the public see him as being back on his feet. Each time he was giving the nominating speech for Al Smith as presidential candidate, the thing he thought he would have been. But, of course, he was also making an appearance for himself. So he wanted to be seen as being back on his feet. How was he going to do that? Franklin couldn't walk. He couldn't even stand. But with 10-pound braces on each leg, a cane in his right arm, a strong son holding his left arm, and such powerful upper body strength that he was able to swing himself forward from his hips, he looked as if he were walking. His physiotherapist deplored this method of ambulation. If he fell, he would crash like a tree. But Franklin was determined. Down in Warm Springs, he and his son Elliot practiced for weeks. While Franklin jerked himself forward, beads of sweat dripping off his brow, and Elliot suffering bruises from his father's steel grip on his arm, they worked up a routine of bantering and laughter to distract onlookers. From New York, Eleanor wrote to Franklin, "I'm telling everyone you're going to Houston without crutches, so mind you stick at it." Their determination, as well as their deliberate deceit, resulted in a spectacular triumph. In November 1928, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected governor of New York. Eleanor, who'd become extremely wary of being subsumed by her role as wife, decided that she would be mistress of the governor's mansion for 4 days a week. On the other 3 days, she would continue with her teaching and political work in Manhattan. Her political activity would have to be more covert. Her name would have to come off the masthead of the Women's Democratic News. But Louis Howe assured her that she could do much the same job behind the scenes. Franklin agreed to this. Eleanor agreed that while she was in New York, Missy would act as hostess at the governor's dinner table. When you think about it, it took courage, boldness, shall we say, radicalism even, for Franklin to agree to having a wife who disappeared for 3 days a week, and for her to agree to Missy acting as hostess of the mansion. Missy, FDR's secretary, had a room just down the corridor from FDR and spent far more time alone with him than Eleanor did. There was plenty of talk about the goings-on in the governor's mansion. No one quite knew what to think. At the beginning of FDR's second gubernatorial term, Sam Rosenman, FDR's speechwriter, moved into the mansion with his wife. Dorothy and I knew the gossip about Missy and FDR and tried to figure out what that relationship was, FDR told a biographer years later. But the Rosenmans remained as mystified as everyone else. Eleanor's relationship with her dashing bodyguard, Earl Miller, was also causing tongues to wag. Mama complained to friends that the state trooper used to be Corporal Miller, who ate with the servants in the kitchen, and now he was Earl and ate with the family. For the next 4 years, Eleanor travelled all over the state with Earl on inspection tours, acting as FDR's eyes and legs. Earl Miller made her less stiff and awkward in front of reporters' cameras. Indeed, indeed, he was the first person to tell her that she had a beautiful smile and she should smile for cameras. Just like Missy, whose flirtatiousness and devotion made FDR feel more like a man, Earl Miller's tender affection and fierce protectiveness made Eleanor feel more like a woman. Missy and Earl both came from humble backgrounds, but this never bothered Franklin or Eleanor. They loved to open up their friends' worlds, giving them opportunities they would otherwise never have had. Here they are in the governor's mansion. Actually, when you look at it, they're almost as good as Oprah Winfrey at the sort of details, the fire, the dog. Here, Franklin kept on going with Missy down to Warm Springs on vacations. That was his favourite spot. He'd now built a house there. Missy's in the middle, passing round food. He's governor at this point. This is 1932. He's always surrounded by friends and colleagues. They're sitting by the pool. And this is Franklin with Earl Miller. You can see that he had a rather positive body image. And this is Louis Howe at his desk. 1932, getting ready for the presidential campaign. As governor of New York during the Depression, FDR showed himself to be a confirmed liberal with the courage to take on the entrenched conservatives in upstate New York. From his office in the executive mansion, he used the new medium of radio to get his ideas out to the people. Eleanor attended political functions, presided over receptions, wrote magazine articles, gave talks, and maintained a vast correspondence. A New Yorker journalist wrote of her, "No woman has a better grasp of the intricacies of state business." In June 1932, FDR was nominated as the Democratic Party's presidential candidate. So here's Louis Howe. He was a major, major force behind the scenes. Very ill man, but that never stopped him. Here they are on their presidential campaign tour. Earl Miller, the bodyguard in the background. Whistle stop. Here's Eleanor at a Democratic women's function. You can see how she had a beautiful smile in evening dresses, that lovely handbag. She looked really wonderful. And by the way, this was at the height of a new romance, which I'm going to tell you about in a minute. However, in November 1932, you know what happened. FDR rumped in as President of the United States, a paraplegic. In her autobiography, Eleanor writes that she was deeply troubled by the prospect of becoming First Lady. It's absurd, this myth, perpetrated by Eleanor and credulously swallowed ever since, that Eleanor was dismayed by the prospect of life in the White House. She had always done and would always do everything in her power to help Franklin fulfill his political dreams, and she genuinely believed that if anyone could pull the country out of the Depression, it was FDR. Eleanor was also convinced that she herself had a role to play, and her closest companion reinforced this. Earl Miller had married. He and Eleanor would always remain close friends, and Eleanor had a new romantic attachment. By the way, all these romantic attachments, I think that's all they, well, this one was somewhat physical, but mostly they were romantic friendships. They always remained friends to the end of her days. She was an absolutely loyal and wonderful giving friend. This was a romance that had sprung up during the election campaign. Here's Lorena Hickok with Earl Miller. They had, as you see, very different body images. It's a little cruel, this photo taken by Eleanor. Lorena Hickok, everyone called her Hick, was the nation's foremost female political journalist. Originally from South Dakota, Hick strode around like a hard-boiled newspaper man, smoked like a chimney, and had a deep sympathy for the struggling people. They met on the campaign trail. Hick was sometimes allowed onto the train to interview Eleanor, and they became friends. They had in common a strong interest in politics, a real concern for the working people, and Hick was a very stimulating, very bright, interesting, loving woman. As it turned out later, exceedingly jealous and possessive, which was difficult. It was Hick's view that America was in trouble and they needed a first lady who made use of her position to speak out. So I think she was extremely good for Eleanor at that phase of her life. She wasn't scared of the White House, but she was naturally working out what her role would be and how to do something useful. In the summer of 1933, that first summer in the White House, Hick was obliged to resign from her job at the Associated Press. By now, she was known throughout the nation as a personal friend of Eleanor's, and for a political journalist, this was disastrous. Indeed, there was quite a bit of gossip about, you know, possible lesbianism. She was a well-known lesbianist herself. Eleanor then found Hick a job with the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, a New Deal program which involved traveling around the country, reporting back on socioeconomic conditions in different regions. So Eleanor, as First Lady, was getting letters from Hick at the same time as Hick was writing these reports for Harry Hopkins, which really told her what conditions were like in depressed America, the South, the Midwest. So she had no illusions. One evening in a shabby hotel room in Baltimore, Lorena Hickok read in the newspapers that Eleanor had given a speech in New York in a blue velvet gown. God damn it, she fumed in her nightly letter to Eleanor. None of us ought to be wearing velvet gowns these days, not when 4,000 Baltimore children couldn't go to school in September because they didn't have clothes. She ended the letter more serenely. I must get to work on my notes. Darling, in a blue velvet dinner gown or out of it, I love you. In between her travels, Hick lived at the White House, sleeping in Eleanor's private suite and eating with Eleanor's official guests. The White House publicity staff carefully snipped Hick's bulky figure out of the official photos. I want to read you just a short passage about life in the White House. With the Roosevelts in residence, the White House was full of laughter and vitality. You know how it was when Uncle Ted was here, how gay and homelike, FDR had told his relatives at the inauguration dinner. Well, that's how we mean to have it. By the way, all 80 Roosevelt relatives who came to the White House that dinner on the day of the inauguration were all Republicans. Franklin and Eleanor enjoyed communal living. Neither of them liked to be alone, and they rarely were. They felt happiest when surrounded by talk, laughter, work, activity. They liked to have friends sweeping across the hallway who wandered into their bedrooms in pajamas to discuss urgent matters. Life in the White House suited the Roosevelts to a T. Every morning at 9 a.m. after FDR had finished his breakfast, Missy and Louis Howe would find him sitting up in his narrow bed, wearing an old sweater, surrounded by newspapers, inserting another cigarette into his cigarette holder. His other two secretaries, Steve Early and Marvin McIntyre, would turn up for their daily bedside briefing. FDR was perfectly capable of talking to passing visitors while he was in the bathroom shaving. "Take a seat on the can," he would tell them cheerily. He would happily continue the discussion while McDuffie, his black valet, helped him dress. FDR was not inhibited. Missy Lehan lived in a sunny little suite on the third floor, the walls of which were covered with photographs of FDR, Eleanor, and the Roosevelt children. Louis Howe lived on the second floor, in the Lincoln Room, across the west hall from Eleanor. I skip. They often had dinner guests, and more formal dinners were carefully stage-managed. Eleanor came late to cocktails, then distracted the guests, chatting about the portraits on the walls, until Franklin had been wheeled into the dining room and transferred from his wheelchair to his seat at the end of the table. As the group walked in, he would welcome them with his big grin. "It's strange to say now," one visitor commented after Franklin's death, "but you didn't really notice he couldn't walk. He was a sort of Mount Rushmore being wheeled around, and all you noticed after a while was the Mount Rushmore part." In their public and private lives, and they blended, their public and they merged. Franklin and Eleanor were idealistic, energetic, hardworking, and deeply democratic. During World War II, FDR became the Allies' chief planner, strategic initiator, and main source of authority. Eleanor was at her best when FDR sent her abroad as a goodwill ambassador to war-torn England in 1942, to the South Pacific in 1943. The Australians loved her. For 12 years in the White House during the Great Depression and throughout World War II, Franklin and Eleanor were viewed throughout the world as embodying the best of the American character. Here's Missy in the White House. Eleanor getting up for morning rides with Eleanor Morgenthau, wife of Henry Morgenthau, the treasurer, in Rock Creek Park. She looked good on a horse, didn't she? Earl Miller got her back onto horses. Here they are. Actually, that's the first year of the presidency, the first time in 12 years that Franklin sailed back to Campo Bello. You can see three of their sons, and you can see Nancy on the left, and you can see Marion at the back, always surrounded by friends. And this was Franklin. This is one of the very rare photos of Franklin in a wheelchair talking to a little neighbor, dog on his lap, and at Top Cottage. Eleanor at Paddington Station, met by the King and Queen. You can see that at 5'11", she towered over the diminutive British royals. She did go for these fox furs, you know, paws and stuff. And lucky you don't see the eyeballs on this particular one. And in the background, you've got Malvina Thompson, known as Tommy, who was Eleanor's absolutely devoted secretary. After Franklin died, they came and lived in Valkill together and worked nonstop. Here's Franklin in the South Pacific. She was getting up pre-dawn hours, hopping into little planes, and bending over incredibly wounded soldiers sometimes, giving them a kiss, telling them she'd write, which she did, to their family. Franklin at Yalta, and just before he died. There were plenty of tragedies during those years in the White House. Louis Howe died. He was an extremely close friend to both of them. Missy Lehan died. She had a stroke and she died 3 years later. The Roosevelt marriage had its trials, plenty of them. Franklin was something of a flirt. He liked to be adored. Hardly surprising for a man with his golden childhood who was doted on by his mother. An incredibly physical man who had to find his sense of manhood again after being crippled. Eleanor was earnest and insecure, with a voracious need to be loved. Hardly surprising for a woman with her tragic childhood, who sensed that her mother never loved her, and whose parents were both dead before she was 10. Even as First Lady, Eleanor always felt like the ugly duckling, the orphan, the girl who deserved love only if she were good. Eleanor expected a great deal from Franklin, and he expected a great deal from her. When it came to relaxation, they preferred to be with others. But FDR, the man at the helm, knew what he owed to Eleanor. He's down in Warm Springs. This is the final trip. Eleanor was very busy with her engagements in New York and Washington, staying behind. He was down there with Daisy Sukley, Laura Delano, her cousin, and indeed he invited Lucy Mercer, who had been married and was now widowed, and who he saw occasionally. There was quite clearly nothing going on now except an old friendship, some nostalgic memories of a romance before he had polio. This was the day before he died. She'd married a very rich man and so had become quite the lady. Here's Franklin in a car. You can see the Secret Service behind and in front, the chauffeur. He was too ill to drive, and Daisy and Laura with him in the back seat. And a very sad photo, the funeral, Eleanor, Charles de Gaulle. FDR, the man at the helm, knew what he owed to Eleanor, far more than the woman behind the scenes. She was the woman on the scene, the woman the press liked to joke was ubiquitous. Eleanor Roosevelt could not have been the woman she was without Franklin, but nor could Franklin Roosevelt have been the man he was without Eleanor. Together they made possible what to most people would have seemed impossible. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, "You must do the things you think you cannot do." She did. FDR did. As a couple, they both did. Thank you. Yeah, yes, if we have any questions, or comments, or arguments, or challenges. Yes.
Well, since you ask, first place I wanted to thank you for your very thoughtful and temperate presentation, and to thank you also for pointing out that we do not know if FDR's relationship with Lucy Mercer was indeed ever consummated. As an employee of the National Park Service, I regularly conduct those tours, like the one you were on. And as you know, I get this question 4 or 5 times a week. Brief caveat. Frankly, I wish I could interview you all day. One brief caveat I had. You said that we know that his relationship with Missy LaHand was sexual to, but we don't know to what extent.
Yes.
I am inclined always to give her the benefit of the doubt simply because she was a serious Catholic, by all accounts. And the only... I don't know that we have any real evidence of that other than their son, Franklin Eleanor's son Elliot, saying that, he saw Missy sitting on father's lap and she went in and out of his bedroom in her nightgown. But none of that proves anything, frankly.
Yes.
If I may just tell you, the first time I ever heard the name Lorena Hickok, I was 7 or 8 years old. She wrote three children's books, at least, for a series called Signature Books. She wrote the story of Franklin D. Roosevelt, story of Eleanor Roosevelt, and story of Helen Keller.
Yes.
And these are all highly moral takes on things as they are written for children. So having said all of that about all of these people, I always assure our groups that I can't believe that anyone involved led a truly immoral life. Given the fact, again, allowing for the fact that all of them were human and had temptations every which way, certainly the fact that Eleanor had gay friends does not mean that she was in any way homosexual. And let me just tie this up by thanking you once again for your very thoughtful and non-lurid treatment of the entire subject. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for that comment. And I think you're quite right, the caveat too. I should not have said, I mean, we don't know. That's the fact. And I've gone through, combed the papers, read between the lines and so on, and I do not know. I think it's extremely unlikely that Eleanor ever had an affair with Earl Miller, who completely respected her as the lady, and it would have been so unlikely. But it was definitely, you know, hands on knees and a bit romantic. That was fine. Lucy Mercer, before Franklin had polio, in the hot Washington summer nights when Eleanor was up with the kids in Campo Bello and he was down in Washington, and he was a little heady because the war was on, raging, and he was in a very important position building up the U.S. Navy. And Lucy was pretty, and most of his male friends were having affairs in the summer while their wives were away. And did he or didn't he with Lucy? It's up to all of us to make up our own minds, because we do not know. Lucy too was a Catholic in her 20s. Franklin had a reputation to keep. He had her reputation to keep. And this was, we're talking about 1918. We're not talking about yet the Roaring 20s. There was no motel. His son, who wrote a book for the Playboy Press, was obviously encouraged to say something about possibly. But I mean, there were no motels until the 50s, so the idea that the son came up with, that they checked in with in a motel one night, nobody's ever seen the record. It's arrant nonsense. Frankly, I think that they probably were doing a bit of passionate kissing in the back of the car on those lovely Virginia roads at night. That's about Lucy, in my opinion. Missy, you're quite right, and this is me thinking to myself. In all those years down in the South, Franklin, who had been a very physical man, he liked to flirt, he was attracted to women. Did he and Missy ever, Missy wrote, there's almost no trace of letters anymore. She certainly, everybody says, loved him ferociously and was in love with him, and the fact is he loved her, he treated her well, he wrote half his will to her when she got a stroke and was in a wheelchair and couldn't speak for the last 3 years. He wanted to look after her medical expenses in case he died. I think, it's up to us again to decide, and I personally sort of conjecture and make it very clear in the book that I'm conjecturing that there was, you know, possibly a sexual attachment. And I do that in the most delicate possible terms because, you know, frankly, this is a difficult subject. I think my problem is partly that I'm not American and that I don't have the same trouble. You know, when you talk about immoral, for me, you know, sometimes part of me rather hopes that he did have an affair with Lucy in those hot Washington evenings while he still had a chance before he had polio. I don't really mind very much. I mean, it hurt Eleanor either way. I doubt whether he did. And as for Missy, you know, if they kissed and whatnot, good. Good. Because what I really care about is that Franklin was building up his spirit again and finding himself again, and that this enabled him to become a governor and, frankly, the best president that we've known, certainly in the 20th century. And that's what really counts, and I wouldn't call either of them at all immoral. In fact, you see this Washington Times review, which is an incredibly nice review and calls me dignified and not gossipy and so on, but it begins with a salacious tittle-tattle. And this is, I think, the trouble with Americans, if you'll permit me to say so, because on the one hand, we don't want to know about affairs, and if there are affairs, then it becomes immoral. Well, of course, the French. I've written a book about Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. We should have had some French lessons in the green room. But the French are much more lenient about those sorts of things, and it's up to each one of us to decide. But in any event, whether there were or not, little things. It was what we're basically talking about with Franklin and Eleanor are romantic friendships, not more. And they allowed them, they gave them strength to do what they had to do, and they gave a great deal to their companions. So I feel that this is a very beautiful story, actually. Thank you for that. That was good. Yes.
In your research, did you ever find out what Eleanor's reaction was when she discovered that FDR had left half of his estate to Missy LeHand?
No, that isn't known. Franklin told that to his eldest son, James. He said, this is the will, and, you know, I hope your mother won't mind. She shouldn't mind. And because Missy predeceased Franklin, it never was anyway. It wasn't an issue. Of course, you're right. Exactly.
I have a question about, I don't think the issue is whether they physically were intimate. I think Eleanor's granddaughter said it best, no one will ever know, and it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
It was that between Hick and Eleanor, it was the nature of the fact that Eleanor was loved.
Yes.
And she needed that. But then I also have to ask, if you have you looked at Eleanor's reaction to those love letters, to the fact that she found out that Lucy Mercer was with Franklin when he died? Because both of those things were seriously devastating. And in that scenario, it may not matter whether it was sexual, but it certainly matters that Eleanor saw it as a betrayal.
Oh, of course. Indeed. And I think that betrayal has possibly ended up putting more weight on, you know, the love of his life stuff, which I don't think Lucy was. Franklin was complaining to Daisy Sukley that Lucy made huge demands on him. She was always wanting this for her nephew, that for her son. Would you please get, you know, Daisy Sukley writes in her extremely interesting diary that, you know, she wished Lucy would leave Franklin, a very busy man, alone a bit. I mean, one hates to think what would have happened if Franklin had Missy as much as she was loving, she wasn't pushing, and, you know, or Lucy, who was actually a rather spoilt woman after her marriage to a very, very wealthy man, and clearly made a lot of demands on him. No, to get back to the betrayal, yes, poor old Eleanor had to go down, you know, the phone call came through in the afternoon. She went down with a couple of companions to Warm Springs to be confronted by her husband's dead body, and then out came the news. The group told her. She said, tell me what happened. And they told her because they knew they had to tell her. I mean, it would come out. And so it was Laura Delano, the sort of leader of the group, Franklin's cousin, who said, Mrs. Lucy Rutherford was here, and Eleanor had, that's Lucy Mercer's married name, and Eleanor had to deal with that information. And then she had all that long funeral train back to Washington to sit and look out of the window and look at the weeping crowds and think about Franklin's betrayal. Franklin, if you think about it, was extraordinary risk taker. He knew he was dying. He was extremely ill. He went down to Warm Springs to try to recover, to invite Lucy Mercer and risk. And I mean, you see, the press covered it up. They covered up the fact. Lucy fled immediately when he collapsed and he died. She was in a car when she found out on the news that he was dead. She disappeared. The White House then had to deal with the problem of telling Lucy and everybody there, because the whole world press was interested in what happened down in Warm Springs. Lucy was, and so was the artist Elizabeth Shrimitoff, who was painting Franklin. They both had press interviews and managed to leave completely out of the picture that Elizabeth Shrimitoff had a press interview and managed to keep out of the picture that she was in the car with Lucy Rutherford. And I mean, if you consider how explosive it would have been at that time, this was just before the end of the war. Franklin died in April 1945. The peace negotiations were at stake. The whole world regarded Franklin as a hero. If it had got out in the press, the tittle-tattle of the woman being there with whom he'd once had an affair, it could have had major impact on world history, frankly. And what a risk he was taking. Yes.
Wasn't Nora Delano instrumental in seeing to it that
that Lucy Mercer and FDR got together on a regular basis?
No, you're thinking of Cousin Alice back in 1918.
No, I'm not. No. I'm not thinking of Cousin Alice.
No.
Does anyone else in here know if that's true? No?
Right. I think he did it on his own bat. When her husband died in 1942, they started to occasionally meet. He would occasionally smuggle her into the White House for an hour or for lunch or for something. Visits. Under a false name. She was called Mrs. Johnson. And but I don't think Laura Delano had anything to do with that, really. Anna, the daughter, knew about it, so that when Eleanor got back to Washington on the funeral train, the first thing she did when she got back to the White House before the funeral that afternoon at 4 o'clock in the East Room was to go and see Anna and say to her, "What did you know? How much did you know? How often did your father see her?" And, of course, the day of the funeral was the worst day of their relationship, mother and daughter. Good questions. You know your stuff. It's scary doing the Roosevelts. I knew I'd be up against people who know things.
All right. Well, thank you all so much. I think Ms. Rowley will be available to sign copies of her book out front by the bookstore. And why don't we give one last round of applause.
Thank you very much.